So let me start by thanking the organizers for putting together this great workshop and inviting me to speak. So far it has been great fun, and I look forward to the rest of it. So this is the theme of the workshop is very focused, but the background of the audience is quite diverse, and I guess we're still in the process of construction of our bridges. And so it's in hope of sort of strengthening the foundations that I decided to take the opportunity to talk about older work from last year for two reasons. One is to sort of convey to the quantum information folk the message that sort of geometrical, covariantly well-defined constructs in holography are very useful. And well, the second reason is that, this work has remained somewhat unheeded by some of the holographers, and I decided to sort of take the opportunity to remind you of the cautionary lessons from it. So I will first sort of give you a bit of an overview or background to sort of exemplify the main point of this use of the covariant constructs, and review sort of two nice constructs that people have been talking about recently. Then I'll review a little bit of this holography that we'll hear a lot more on Thursday, and talk about some of the limitations of that construct, and then try to take a constructive approach to run with the idea that motivated this progress and exemplifies this power of the covariant constructs. Okay, so just to motivate, ADS-CFT, as you all know, has been very useful in giving us insight both into the field theory and into the quantum gravity. And my feeling is that we have so far still just seen the tip of the iceberg, and that there's a lot more that it can teach us once we sort of understand the dictionary between the two sides a lot better. And of course, the naive expectation, which is very natural, is that physically important or somehow natural constructs on one side of the correspondence should have a correspondingly natural counterpart, albeit rephrased in completely different language, in the dual. And the sort of amount to how well-defined or the robustness of the concepts should likewise match between the two sides. And given all this recent progress in sort of having hints at relations between sort of the quantum information constructs, especially entanglement and geometry, it's very natural to consider sort of geometrical constructs in the bulk. And as I said, a very useful tool in thinking about such constructs is sort of insisting on those constructs to be well-defined, robustly well-defined in sort of any space-time that's relevant for the ADS side, asymptotically ADS space-time, but not insisting on any symmetries. So the main message is that although it's very useful to formulate correspondence in regimes where we can do explicit calculations, which restricts us to cases with enough symmetry, ultimately, it's also useful to separate ourselves from the place where we can calculate explicitly and ask sort of much more general questions, that this is not just an idle exercise, but can have some real use. All right, so to exemplify this on well-known examples, one we have already heard a lot about this morning is the Ryu Takanagi proposal for the holographic entanglement entropy. So there, in static configurations, of course, the proposal is to take a minimal surface at a constant time slice, and the entanglement entropy of a given region on the boundary is given by the quarter of the area of the minimal surface. Of course, that's not well-defined in general time-dependent situations because, well, for one, if you deform the surface in a time-like direction, you can decrease its area arbitrarily. And two, this constant time slice which you're taking has no special meaning when the geometry has time dependence. It's just some coordinate artifact. And so, of course, you need to covariantize it because entanglement entropy is a fully robust notion applicable in time-dependent situations. And so that's what we have done. And, well, the simplest candidate seems to be the one that's holding up water, which is simply that instead of taking a minimal surface at a constant time slice, you take an extremal surface in the full bulk. Okay, so that absolves you of having to specify this time slice, and now it's a fully well-defined, you know, covariant prescription valid in arbitrarily time-dependent asymptotically ABS space-time. Now, I say simplest, it's actually somewhat gratifying that, well, we came up with sort of four candidates that were sort of obvious when we were thinking about this with Mukunthan Tadashi. And, you know, after almost a decade of two of those candidates lying dormant, they seem to be reviving themselves. So the second candidate here ends up being equivalent to extremal surface, namely a surface from which their null expansions both vanish in both directions, okay, which is reminiscent of Busso's covariant entropy bound and Leitch's construction, which is earlier example of the power of, you know, covariance. A third candidate is something that's reminiscent of what Tadashi talked about this morning. It was a minimal surface and volume maximizing slice, which turns out not to give the entanglement entropy, but might, well, at least the volume maximizing slice might be useful for something. And the fourth one was this area of the rim of the causal wedge, which sort of got revived a few years ago. And I'll use a little bit of it, so let me just remind you of the construction here. So you take the boundary region, you take its domain of dependence, and then the causal wedge is the set of points, well, is given by the intersection of the future and the past of the domain of dependence in the bulk. So it's set of points which lie on causal curves which start and end in this domain of dependence. And the rim here is what we call the causal information surface, and quarter of its area is what we call causal holographic information, abbreviated by chi. And, well, in special cases, like pure ADS, this actually is the extremal surface that whose area, quarter area, gives the entanglement entropy, but in general they differ. And it's certainly an interesting question of, given how basic a construct this is in the bulk, a sort of even more primal construct than the extremal surface because it only cares about, well, at least the geometrical region only cares about the causal structure, not even the full geometry, what is the corresponding dual in the field theory? So there have been several proposals, but we still don't sort of know first principles, you know, construction of this. But these sort of constructs already made an appearance in various recent discussions, and even not so recent discussions. For example, if you want to ask, well, is there somehow a natural bulk dual of the reduced density matrix in the field theory, pioneered by Mark and company and by Raphael and friends. And if you sort of take the philosophy that it should be, you know, something nice in the bulk, okay, there are two sort of natural candidates you might think of. So, well, the most basic geometrical construct, the simplest geometrical construct in Lorentzian spacetimes are sort of causal sets which are bounded by null geodesics, All right? And now you can take these null, these congruences of null geodesics, which define this causal set, and there's sort of two basic options. One is you can start the null geodesics from the boundary, okay? And this is effectively what gives us this causal wedge, okay? You start with a boundary region, and then you define a causal set based on the intersection of future and past of that boundary region. So you start your geodesics on the boundary, or you can start from the bulk. In that case, you have to specify some place in the bulk where you start from. So the natural place then is this extremal surface that's anchored on your boundary region of interest. And that's what gives us what we called recently in this paper the entanglement wedge. Okay, which is the region, again, it's a causal set, causally defined region, and it's the region of sort of space-like separated points towards the region A from the extremal surface. So both of these sets are generated, these wedges, so they're codimension zero bulk regions. Those are both defined by null geodesics. They're bounded by null geodesics. And in pure ADS, the two constructs coincide. Okay. So this is exactly the same picture as what Tom showed us in the last talk, so flipped. But in general, they're distinct. And to illustrate why they're distinct in a very important way. And you know, you might think it takes maybe a little bit of thought to appreciate that. Despite the fact that they're both defined by just null geodesics, there's a difference between whether you take which way the null geodesics go. So here's an example of causal wedge, just to illustrate, just to give you a plot of what the thing looks like. So here it's a causal wedge in a geometry with a black hole. And in fact, the causal wedge can be sort of topologically interesting. It can have holes eaten out of it, because of course, if you're inside the black hole, there is no chance you're getting out to the boundary, much less out to the boundary in the domain of dependence of this region A. And so the inside of the black hole is certainly not within the causal wedge. Okay, so the causal wedge has this hole. But the important thing that I want to illustrate by this plot is that these null generators coming from the tip of this causal wedge on the boundary come around the black hole and they meet on the other side of the black hole before meeting the bottom ones. And so once two generators which lie on the boundary of the causal set intersect, then beyond that point, those parts of the geodesics are no longer on the boundary of that causal set, simply because past that point, that region is already time-like separated rather than null separated from what you want. You can always deform, you know, this null geodesics into some time-like geodesic. And so you have to cut off the boundary at this, what's called the crossover seam. These crossover seams sort of start at caustics and sort of end. And here the crossover seams are a finite distance. Well, sorry, they appear, they don't reach the boundary because the boundary is the defining starting point. Okay, so the crossover seams are some space-like codimension two regions which are sort of towards the bulk. On the other hand, here's an example of entanglement wedge in completely different space-time. So I just didn't have time to make the plot of entanglement wedge in the same context. But here to illustrate the point, you start not from the boundary, but from the bulk. So now you take your null geodesics, which start from here. And again, in general, they're going to intersect at some point before reaching the boundary. And again, you have to cut off your causal region at the intersections, at this crossover seam. But now this crossover seam is something that ends on the boundary. It's still a space-like generically codimension two region, but it now is up here rather than down here. And that has sort of important consequences. So, let me just say, so here's yet another example of this causal wedge, which is generated by null geodesic starting from the tip of the domain of dependence. And if you continue it past this causal information surface, this rim of the causal wedge, which are this purple curve for this region and this purple curve for the complement region, if you continue those null generators past that, they form what we call the causal shadow, which is a region which is causally disconnected from both the domain of dependence of your selected region A and its domain of dependence of its complement. Okay, so the statement, we used the property of these null generators to show that, the causal wedge must always be contained inside the entanglement wedge, or in other words, this extremal surface that's anchored on this region must always lie inside the causal shadow. Okay, so this was already presaged by Aaron, and we proved it in this paper last fall. But the consequences is, well, first of all, the HRT prescription is non-trivially consistent with CFT causality, namely how entanglement entropy can change if you deform the state. Okay, so I won't go into that story, but that was a non-trivial check of the prescription. You can also very robustly conclude what we call entanglement plateaus, which is a saturation of the difference between entanglement entropy of a given region minus the entanglement entropy of its complement as a function of that region size. So this quantity saturates in certain cases, like having a black hole, to the thermal entropy. Okay, so this is what we dubbed entanglement plateaus. And that again robustly follows you can calculate in explicit situations, but it robustly follows just from this statement that the causal wedge is inside the entanglement wedge. And well, for purposes of asking how much of a spacetime in the bulk can we reconstruct from information in the reduced density matrix, if you believe that you can reconstruct the entire entanglement wedge, then it's very curious, because the entanglement wedge can actually reach deep inside black holes. And so that makes a important statement or important lesson from that standpoint. So this is just to exemplify, what you can do without having to explicitly calculate locations of these surfaces or areas of these surfaces, just from properties of sort of basic GR stuff, properties of what null congruences do. Okay, so now let me turn the page and talk about this holographic story. Okay, so I'll start with a bit of a first just a review of the picture that these guys introduced. So it's a very beautiful sort of story that has since taken off, but it's also one which is whose original motivation was very limited. Okay, so let me just give the basic picture that motivated the story, and then talk about it, in what senses it is limited. Okay, so these folks wanted to characterize a sort of a collective ignorance of a family of observers. Okay, so you can
<I'm sorry>.
Calling Vijay. Okay, I'll continue. Okay, so there's actually two different collective ignorance constructs which are very distinct. One is sort of for bulk observers, and one is for boundary observers. So let me start with bulk observers. Okay, so these guys wanted to consider set of bulk observers who are always external, who never see anything happening in a certain space-time region. Okay, so there is a bulk hole, which is defined by the SRIM, which are called C, some curve, in three dimensions. And it's domain of dependence of the region that it contains. All right, and you consider observers like this one who are causally disconnected from the whole, and you consider all such observers. Okay, so their collective ignorance is basically not knowing what's happening inside this hole. And it's clear that they can't last forever in this global time, because once they get, you know, past the future of the rim, they can see inside what happened inside the black hole. So you have to be eternally accelerating sufficiently fast to, you know, get out to the ADS boundary. If they are inertial observers that slosh around, or even uniformly accelerating ones that just stay at constant radial position, that's not good enough. They actually have to get out to remain out of causal contact with this hole.
Now,
that's up. You specify the hole, and you specify it by its rim, where you just take the domain of dependence of the inside region. Okay, so that's up to you to define, and then you want to ask, what is the collective ignorance pertaining to that region? Okay, so you pick a region, and then they want to define what is the collective ignorance. This is, by the way, what later Rob and Bianchi sort of try to sort of ask, what is the entanglement of that region. All right. Now, what about the boundary observers? Well, let's just take what the region that these bulk observers would sort of limit to. It's clear that boundary observers wouldn't see inside this hole as long as there is sort of space like separated from it. And so here you want to restrict attention to finite time duration strip. Okay, so that's what these guys called time strip. So basically you can think of this as boundary observers who have just a finite time to make all their measurements. And because they have finite time to make measurements, you can easily believe that there is something that they're missing. They don't know the full state, even though, you know, they can see the entire sort of Cauchy slice here. They still don't know the entire system. So there is some collective ignorance associated with them. All right, so you can think of, instead of thinking about, well, okay, how much collective ignorance is there when you have a finite time duration to make your measurements, you can think about it in the following way. Take a family of, say, static observers here, and to each one of them associate a finite interval, whose domain of dependence precisely gives you, ends on the strip, and the collection of all such static observers with sort of such intervals around the cylinder span this time strip. Right? So the original paper sort of conflated the two notions of collective ignorance. But we'll see that in general, of course, they are distinct, and the constructions that you have, you know, going from time strip to the bulk hole and backwards is not reversible in general. But okay, in this picture that I have shown you and some mild variations thereof, it is reversible. And well, initially this collective ignorance was dubbed residual entropy. And later, after Rob and friends' work, renamed to differential entropy, basically because, well, this presented a very nice formula using strong subadditivity to phrase this entropy, what's now called the differential entropy, in terms of, if you take a continuum version of this, in terms of a derivative of entanglement entropy with respect to a region size integrated around the full boundary. And that is related, you can show that that is related to the area of this well, or length in this case, of this rim of the hole in certain situations, all right? So this is a very nice and appealing formula, but it's not universally valid, all right? So there are various limitations in the original formulation, and some of those remain even in all the subsequent formulations, and some of those have subsequently been sort of addressed. So let me just remind you what are the sort of list all the limitations. Again, some of them have been already appreciated. So the original formulation is, of course, well, meaningful in free bulk dimensions, simply because you're taking these intervals and you're ordering them. You're taking intersections of them and you're seeing how this varies as you go around the ADS boundary. So that requires some ordering. And so obviously if you have sort of higher dimensional regions, there is no natural ordering in general. And relatedly, you can think of this extremal surfaces. Oh, I forgot to say one thing. Let me just say one thing going back here. This formulation, you associate an entanglement entropy to this interval that gives you the domain of dependence whose tips are given by the time duration. And this extremal surface, which calculates the entanglement, is precisely in ADS3 is precisely the Rindler horizon of a bulk observer who stays outside the black hole. Or in other words, it's this causal information surface for the causal wedge. So this is the causal wedge pertaining to this interval in ADS3. Okay, so in ADS3, this was this nice Rindler horizon, but in general, that's not the case. And the construction can be generalized by taking extremal surfaces that are tangent to your bulk hole rim. But in higher dimensions, there is not unique tangent extremal surface. In three dimensions, where your rim is a curve, there's always a unique geodesic that's tangent to a given curve at a given point, because you specify the position and direction, and that determines the entire geodesic. In higher dimensions, there are, of course, infinitely many surfaces, extremal surfaces, that are tangent to a given surface. So you need additional specifications. Okay, so these guys circumvented partially both of these problems by considering additional symmetry that allows for this ordering and gives a unique tangent surface in higher dimensions. Okay, so this is a higher dimensional generalization. So Rob and friends considered strips in higher dimensions such that you have, again, ordering of these spatial strips, and you can effectively carry the same story, again, now having extremal surfaces that are tangent to your bulk hole. And here we have a sort of circular symmetry. But now this sort of deviates from this collective ignorance concept that one started out with initially. Because first of all, if you start with such regions, they don't regenerate the correct time strip. In other words, if you look at the time strip given by the region on the boundary that's causally disconnected from your bulk hole, that time strip is much larger than the time strip you would have obtained from these surfaces, okay, which are just anchored on the domain of dependence of these surfaces, which is shorter. Secondly, if you think of the time strip as being traversed by local boundary observers, and then consider the regions that form the domain of dependence pertaining to those observers, you would never get anything other than circles or balls. Okay, so you would not get these regions. So now this is a construction, which is a very nice construction, but ceases to have anything to do with this original formulation of this residual entropy. All right, so that was one limitation, the dimensionality. Perhaps a more severe limitation of the, again, the original formulation was that it was valid only in pure ADS, because, again, the meaning of the residual entropy relied on, you know, this extremal surface coincided with this Rindler horizon, this causal information surface, which is not true in general. In fact, it need not even hold for, you know, quotients of ADS3, which are locally ADS3, where you do have, although the causal information surface is an extremal surface, this need not give the entanglement entropy in general. And so the formula that you write in terms of entanglement entropies is not, this is not the correct quantity that you would universally be using. So here, so you don't have this residual entropy interpretation. And perhaps more severely, although in pure ADS, the extremal surfaces of interest are anchored on the boundary, in general, that doesn't have to be the case. They can sort of wrap around and terminate somewhere in the bulk or self-intersect in the bulk. So you know, this is not robust when you start deforming the geometry sufficiently. Now, this has been, again, this has been generalized to other spacetimes, in fact, other theories. But again, the main point is that the generalization is a geometrical construct which utilizes extremal surfaces in the bulk, but those extremal surfaces need no longer be giving the entanglement entropy. Okay, so in that sense, sort of calling it even differential entropy is a bit of a, well, misnomer or, you know, dangerous thing to sort of associate universally with entropy, because it's not always entropy. It's an interesting construct, but we don't know what it means robustly in the field theory. Sometimes in tame enough situations, it's the entanglement entropy, but not always. Yeah.
So the homotopy constraint will always tell you that the extremal surfaces should be anchored in the boundary. What mm-hmm. do you mean with that? When we consider each other.
Right. So if you start, so the starting point, so you have some, let's say, boundary here, but you then have this bulk hole. And the construction from the differential entropy is to look at extremal surfaces that are sort of tangent to the bulk hole. And you take some combination of them such that you only keep the little bits that are tangent, the rest of it cancels out very niftily. And so you sort of recover the area of this bulk hole boundary. But of course, if you have some complicated spacetime that's asymptotically ADS, you're not guaranteed that these don't do something crazy here. Okay? Because you define them as being tangent to the bulk hole somewhere in the bulk. And of course, the other problem is even if they do get to the bulk, even if they do get to the boundary, there might well have been a homologous extremal surface anchored on the same region with smaller area. And so then the entanglement entropy of this region is given by the area of this guy and not this guy, which is why the, you know, why the formula in terms of entanglement entropy need not always be valid. All right. So another limitation is that the formulation was specified at a constant, this curve was at a constant time, or equivalently in static geometries, the time strip was time flip symmetric. So if you don't have that case, there's first of all an ambiguity in what set of boundary observers you can be taking. So let me just illustrate that. So here there's a, so this is a boundary spacetime, this is time space, and you take a time strip which is time flip symmetric, a simple one like this, which keeps going. And then the natural thing to consider is the static observers, like in my first picture. And the domain of dependence anchored on that corresponding interval is actually the one that reaches the deepest into the bulk. So if you take a different observer, like the one given by this dashed line, their corresponding interval that's defined by the sort of domain of dependence would be something whose extremal surface anchored on these two points doesn't reach as far. Okay? In fact, if this becomes infinitely boosted, if that observer is null, then the causal wedge degenerates all the way to the boundary. And so there's an optimal set of observers here to use, which are the static ones. But that would not be the case if you have a non-time flip symmetric strip, like here. So if you take this observer, their causal wedge reaches somewhere. But if you take a boosted observer, this causal wedge actually reaches deeper than this one. Okay. In fact, in this simple situation, it's just one is boost of the other, but you can consider much more complicated situations. So you say, okay, fine, so let's take the set of observers for each point at the beginning of the time strip. There's some observer whose proper time within the strip is the longest. Okay, so that's a geometric construct. So let's take the one whose proper time is maximized. But that's not always good enough, because if you have a situation like this, so here what I have done is I have just doubled up half of this, flipped it over. This observer's maximized proper time gets them to here. This one gets them to here by flip symmetry. And there is no way, no observer starting from here who'd be maximizing for this slice. Okay, so this would not be even covered. So there's an ambiguity of what, you know, family of observers you want to be taking. That's one problem. The other problem, actually already illustrated here, well, other naive problem, is that now if you want to calculate the entanglement entropy of some intervals and look at their intersections, they're not always lying at, you know, the same time. So now it's a sort of much more strange quantity to consider. You have to consider, you know, an interval like this and some interval that doesn't even lie on the same time slice. So you might say, well, what does it mean to take the intersection of them? Is it just this point or what? That problem is partially resolved by saying, well, don't think of the intervals. Think of the full domains of dependence in the boundary. So here I have an interval A, here I have an interval B, and the intersection of those two intervals, even though I'm not, they look like they're not touching, is actually some interval that looks like this, because the intersection of the domains of dependence always makes sense. Okay, so you can do this. In fact, that's the construction that was used subsequently. But it still requires you to consider, in this three-dimensional situation, two sort of time slices, one spanned by the right endpoint, one spanned by the left endpoint. And you might still wonder, well, what is then the meaning of, you know, what are you doing in the field theory? You have to calculate not entanglement entropies at one time, but at some, you know, combination of times. All right, so that's this. And finally, and this is the part that I think has not really been addressed anywhere, is that the construct is valid for, well, what I call sufficiently tame setup, all right? So in particular, if it's not sufficiently tame, again, the construction does not respect the sort of causal requirement of this original motivation of residual entropy. So the time strip you get can be now in causal contact with the bulk hole. And this construction need not be reversible in the sense that distinct bulk holes could lead to the identical time strip, and conversely, distinct time strips can lead to identical bulk holes. Okay, so to illustrate that, here's an example of a tame, what I would call a tame setup. All right, so let me sort of explain this a bit. So here I have taken ADS3 curve at constant time, so overcoming all the previous limitations, and but now this is not at constant radius, this is some slightly wiggly curve. So the red curve on this plot is the profile in this boundary angle of the radial position in some, or arctan of the radial position of this bulk curve. The black curve here is the temporal position of the corresponding time strip. And well, this blue curve is the radial position of this extremal surface tangent at a given angle at phi equal to zero, corresponding to this observer. So here you can see that the extremal surface is, well, tangent to the bulk curve, but everywhere outside it, all right? But if that doesn't happen, so generically, if you deform this bulk curve a little bit, or if you say keep the wiggliness of the time strip, but make it a little bit longer like here, you get something that I would not call tame. Okay, so in the first case, you take a smooth bulk curve, but it doesn't give a smooth time strip, it gives a kinky time strip. Okay, so here what happens is that, well, I have zoomed in on the next picture. These generators from this bulk curve actually intersect. There's some crossover seam, and they come up. This position is not monotonic in the original angle on the bulk curve. And so this extremal surface that's tangent here actually gets into the bulk curve. So that means that although these points up here are now related to some point on the whole rim, they're time-like related to some other point on the whole rim. Okay, so this bit does not belong to the time strip in the sense that this brown part is actually in causal contact with the whole. Similarly, conversely, if you start with a smooth time strip, now you take the generators, now you look at the null generators that are normal to the time strip going backwards. Again, they can give you bits of the bulk curve that are, time-like related. Okay, and here what happens to the extremal surface, although it's tangent and sort of outside locally, the bulk curve, it intersects some other piece of these generators. Oops, sorry. To go back here. So here the surface intersects this part of the rim. Okay. So in neither of such cases is the residual entropy interpretation valid. And in fact, originally, the holographers sort of called this generic. It's generic in the sense that it's not a single configuration. It's a family, it's an open set of configurations, but it's certainly not generic in the sense of being valid for, a full class of asymptotically, ADS spacetime, or even pure ADS3, but all curves here, all right? And in fact, I came to appreciate how non-generic it is in trying to plot something that doesn't look as boring as the original picture that I drew, and all of the cases I tried to construct that showed some deviation were falling into these sick categories. All right, so the upshot of all this is that the differential entropy is not capturing the residual entropy. But I want to ask, this notion of residual entropy was an interesting one. Okay, so is there some quantity which is applicable robustly for any asymptotically ADS geometry in any dimension for any region specification? And of course, the answer is yes. And so that's the last part of the talk. And it's very simple. It's already sort of follows from what I have said, which is just use the causal constructs that the basic idea of the residual entropy asks you to. All right, so there are two distinct regions, each corresponding to the starting point, because there are two starting points. One is residual entropy for the bulk observers who don't see a certain bulk region, and one is residual entropy for boundary observers who are confined to making their measurements within a certain time strip. Okay, and these two are distinct. Okay, so if you start with a bulk hole that you're not supposed to see, then this is what I call, you start with a rim of the hole, so I'll call it a rim wedge, all right, which is just simply the set of spacetime, bulk spacetime points, which is space-like separated from the whole. Right? If you start from the boundary time strip, okay, I'll call it the strip wedge, that's the set of points that are time-like, well, that are connected, that lie on a causal curve that starts and ends in this time strip. Okay, so this is the analog of the entanglement wedge, and this is the analog of the causal wedge. It's a direct generalization of these constructs, now not requiring this C to be an extremal surface or this to be a domain of dependence of any region, right? And as for the causal wedge and the entanglement wedge, both of these wedges are, again, robustly well-defined. And so what can we do with them? Okay, so let me talk a little bit more about them. So the two wedges coincide only in, well, tame enough situations again. So the procedure of going from the hole to the strip and back to the hole is reversible only if, what happens, only if these generators don't intersect each other. All right, so that means only if the time strip is short enough duration or this bulk hole is not too wiggly. In general, you'll either get a crossover seam here or crossover seam here, again, depending on what was your starting point. And once you get a crossover seam, if you start from the hole, from the bulk hole, you create this time strip and go back from the time strip, you don't recover back the entire hole. You recover back only some regions of it. So these regions, you recover back. But if you go back from this point, here you don't see any of these generators. So you cannot recover these portions. Instead, what the prescription tells us to do is to take the past of this future boundary, okay? And past of this point is the past light cone. So that lies, because this crossover seam is necessarily space-like, the past of this point lies below it. And so this recovered bulk hole is outside, okay? So this recovered strip wedge from this rim wedge is always within the rim wedge. Similarly, if you start with a time strip in this situation, create the bulk hole, and then try to use the rim to recreate the time strip, again, from these, now your crossover seams are down here, and so the future light cone from these points lies above the space-like crossover seams, and so you recover a time strip which is larger. So again, in both cases, you can generically prove that always this strip wedge has to be contain the rim wedge, which is a direct analog of this causal wedge lying within the entanglement wedge. All right, so you can prove robustly this sort of inclusion property, and you also have a criterion for when this construction is not reversible. Incidentally, for pure ADS3, the criterion is has to do whether the expansion, the null expansion from this curve is positive or not. In general, that's not a good enough criterion. For general spacetimes, even in three dimensions, you can have everywhere positive expansion, but still have this non-reversibility. Okay, because these generators can caustic even if they start out with positive expansion. All right, so this leads to an interesting puzzle. Okay, so you might have thought that, well, both residual entropies should be somehow given by the area of the rim. So from the boundary residual entropy, you take the time strip, you construct the bulk hole, and you might have thought that the residual entropy is given by the area of that bulk hole, which was the expectation proposed here. And of course, you can show that that has a finite area and all that, so it's very appealing. Similarly, well, if you start with the bulk residual entropy already there, you expect that's just the uncertainty of that is the entanglement entropy of that region. So that is given by the area of that whole rim. But this is very this leads to a very surprising conclusion. Well, first of all, let's take them one by one. The milder one is the first one. If the boundary residual entropy is given by the area of the rim, then it means that these distinct boundary time strips can have the same whole rim, as we have seen here, right? These two time strips have the same whole rim, and therefore, purportedly the same residual entropy. And so that leads to the conclusion that even though this family of observers going between this green boundaries has longer time for their measurements, their residual entropy actually doesn't care about it. They would have the same residual entropy as these shorter-lived observers. So even though you can make your measurements longer and you think you might buy yourself some more, if the residual entropy is given by this area, then that's not the case. More severely, the distinct bulk whole rims, which means that but according to this would be different residual entropy, can have the same boundary time strip. Okay, so here the picture is the distinct, these guys would have different areas, but nevertheless the time strip is the same. That's more problematic, because if you think that you can recover this bulk residual entropy from the boundary observers, you can't do it by boundary local observers because they only have access to this time strip, and the time strips were the same for these two cases, which were saying had different residual entropy. So there's something weird going on. There's something weird in the sense that you cannot, this sort of collective ignorance is more than just the composite of the individual observer's ignorance. There's something much more non-local going on, and these boundary observers can't recover the bulk residual entropy. Okay, so I'm almost out of time, so let me summarize. So one lesson was that it's very important to sort of distinguish in the constructs the different regions of regimes of applicability. You need to specify sort of the dimensionality. Is the prescription only valid in 2+1 dimensions or arbitrarily many dimensions? Is the bulk geometry only specified to be pure ADS or quotients of ADS, or maybe only static asymptotically ADS spacetimes? Or is it, you know, valid for arbitrary physically well-behaved spacetimes? Is the specification of your family of observers, this collective ignorance, is that required to be this time flip symmetric situation, or maybe sufficiently tame? Or again, is it sort of arbitrarily robust situation? Depending on, you know, which ones of these are valid, you can subsequently use that construction for, corresponding extensions. But if you, for example, have something that's based on, you know, being valid only in pure ADS, and you want to say you're using this construct to reconstruct bulk geometry, then it's a bit dubious because you only have the pure ADS geometry. You don't reconstruct something, you know, unknown. So it's important to specify, you know, where the constructions are valid. And, you know, I don't mean to be a, so this is not to be a, you know, annoying killjoy for constructions that are beautiful in a limited setting, because I think this is an important opportunity for us to acknowledge the limitations, because that way we can probe the ADS-CFT correspondence much better. Okay, so I think the beautiful pictures that work in limited regimes are not, you know, to be completely thrown away, but one should not suppress when they're not valid. I think, yeah, one should take the opportunity to, you know, probe this, to use the lessons. Now, the useful tool, and the main point of the talk was that this general covariance is a sort of very powerful guiding principle for constructing these physically interesting quantities. So we have seen, if you start from the boundary, we had the causal wedge and the strip wedge. If you start from the bulk, you have the entanglement wedge and the rim wedge. And although the boundaries are generated by null geodesics, the fact that these have crossover seams generically have important implications, like this inclusion properties and these puzzles about the residual entropy. And let me leave you with sort of one last question. I have taken the assumption that residual entropy somehow is a nice construct that makes sense. And if it does, it sort of gives us a more detailed handle on the on somehow the structure of the state. But it's not clear to me that it is necessarily sort of well defined for some arbitrary family of observers. So let me leave you with that question and end.
So comment number one is that essentially Brian Swindle proved that the notion of collective ignorance was not the correct one to interpret differential entropy. So in talking about how collective ignorance is not the best way of thinking, or just is plain wrong to think about what differential entropy is, I think his contribution should be mentioned. So I wanted to say that. Then the second comment is that Rob and Matt Hedrick and Jason Veen's work essentially covariantized the construction. So I just wanted to make sure that
I have mentioned.
The third comment is that the cases you distinguished where the rim wedge versus the other type of wedge are relevant. Those cases are simply distinguished by whether the curve is convex or not.
No, it's not. It's only for period S
that
is distinguished in that way.
Okay, then we should talk about that. Mm-hmm. Then the fourth comment is that in the way of interpreting what this is, if it's not collective ignorance, Asher Kaden and Nima Lashkari and Brian and I wrote a paper about the information theoretic interpretation of differential entropy. So I wanted to say that there's some notion out there that gives an interpretation for this quantity. Then the fifth comment.
But that's not the residual entropy, that's the differential entropy.
That's the differential entropy, right?
And that's not always given by the entanglement entropies. So it's not a formula taking an entanglement entropy
and
its derivative.
Great, and this brings me to my final
then,
comment.
I mean, that was the entwinement, but we don't know what entwinement is in the first theory.
And the last comment is exactly about entwinement. I just wanted to give them a little advertisement for my talk on Thursday, which will not be principally about entwinement, but we will see some tensor network appearance of entwinement. So hopefully we'll put that on a stronger.
Very good. Okay. Was there a question?
Oh no! I
okay.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody wish to venture a question?
What's the name of that type of tree?
Informative tree.
Very good. So if we don't have other questions, let's thank Veronica.